I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, looking with some local pride, some laughs, some puzzlement at just how Boston noir became our sound and our style. On the lookout with us are the poet Nick Flynn, who wrote the memoir of meeting his runaway father in the Pine Street Inn, the Drunk Tank, and Homeless Shelter. The book is called Another Bull Night in Suck City. 10 years old now, and it gets better with age. Also, Rick Marinick, a South Boston writer from the noir shadows himself, a one-time state trooper who did long prison time for robbing armored trucks and came back to write some of the best fiction about the real Boston. Also, Anna Mundo, the book critic who watches and listens and reads it all out in Shutesbury, Massachusetts, with an Irish sensibility, which probably helps. So what is this thing called noir, this worldview under an overcast sky and fishy salt air smell of the Boston waterfront? You can hear a lot of it right here in the broken voice of Robert Mitchum playing Eddie Coyle in the movie. He's in a breakfast joint with a rookie gun dealer, and he's warning him that there's a price to be paid for screwing up. Eddie Coyle is telling the kid how the mob smashed his own hand in a desk drawer, gave him an extra set of knuckles as penance for non-delivery of guns that he had promised back in the day.
What makes it hurt worse, what makes it hurt more, is knowing what's going to happen to you, you know? There you are. They just come up to you and say, look, you made somebody mad, you made a big mistake, and now there's somebody doing time for it. There's nothing personal in it, you understand, but it just has to be done. Now get your hand out there. You think about not doing it, you know? When I was a kid in Sunday school, this nun, she used to say, stick your hand out. I stick my hand out, whap, she knocked me across the knuckles with a steel-edged ruler. So one day I says, when she told me, stick your hand out, I says, no. She whapped me right across the face with the ruler, same thing. They put your hand in a drawer, and somebody kicks the drawer shut. Ever hear bones breaking? Just like a man snapping a shingle. Hurts like a bastard.
So many of the noir themes are right there in Robert Mitchum's Eddie Coyle speech. Due credit to the late novelist George V. Higgins, this pain and inescapable punishment. Even the Sunday school nuns ruled viciously by the sword. Nothing personal, he says. There's a fatalism about cold business. And, of course, his great language, sound of bones snapping like a shingle. Listeners, is that your noir? Where do you recognize it? In Ben Affleck movies or Dennis Lehane novels or in your neighborhood? Join the conversation at 800-423-8255. Nick Flynn, welcome to Open Source. You're off a different branch of noir, sort of civilian, semi-suburban story. In your case, it starts in Scituate. Your father is the center of it, even when he's gone missing, which is most of the time. He's a pretend-to-be artist and writer. He bragged he was the next great American poet, but he was a con man in and out of prison, and he was a bad drinker. Mother turns out to be a suicide as you are coming of age, Nick. And the funny part is you're drawn to the combat zone, to drugs and drinking yourself, and then to the care of drunks and homeless men at the Pine Street Inn in the south end of the city. You moved into the combat zone when it was still dangerous. I want to know why, Nick. And then where was your Boston noir?
Yeah, well, I mean, it started in the, you know, you say it started in Scituate in the suburbs, and but really, it did begin, you know, when I moved into Boston in my early 20s after my mother died, and I ended up in the combat zone, and mostly it was an abandoned building then, and it's a sort of classic noir setting, really. Mm-hmm. It's an abandoned strip joint in the combat zone.
The Naked Eye and all that.
Well, yeah, it was the former Good Time Charlie's is the building we moved into. You know, it was owned, you know, it was reputedly owned by the mafia, and, you know, that's who we'd pay our money to. And they let us stay there for some reason. And you know, the drinks were still on the tables downstairs, still in the bar when we moved in from when it had been shut down. And there was something about the combat zone that does feel, I mean, I hadn't really articulated it that way, but it did feel like a very noir world because it was a It was a liminal space. It was a space. It wasn't a neighborhood, and it wasn't a business zone. It was just this space in between where people would come to act out their impulses or act on their impulses. And it was you know, bordered by the theater district, which is also another place, another sort of fantasy zone. And then on the other side is Chinatown, which is you know, also just coincidentally the name of one of the great noir movies.
Well, Nick Flynn, what was your state of mind?
Living in the combat zone? Well, yeah. It was my early 20s in Boston. It was Boston in the 1980s, and it felt very exciting to me. There was a great like adrenaline rush, and to be in a city, to have escaped the suburbs, and to live in the city, and to also to take over a whole building in downtown seemed like it was still possible to do that back then. Yet it was rough. I mean, you know, there were rough people in the streets, and you had to keep your head up, and you had to, you know, if you came home at night, which we often did, you know, if we came home at night drunk, which we often did, it was dangerous. You'd have to, you know, watch yourself.
Nick Flynn, what was your route through that world, so to speak? I mean, there was a night when you and your pals drove a truck across Boston Common, which you weren't supposed to do, but I mean, fill in some of those spaces.
Well, that was. I mean, there was a couple nights of doing that, but I think what you're thinking about is when I actually worked with at the Pine Street Inn. We drove the homeless outreach van, and we at night. So that was the thing. I think most noir takes place at night. It seems like that's the world it inhabits. It's outside of the workaday world. It's in the shadows and at night, and when there's other opportunities for bad behavior, perhaps.
You had told your mother, Nick, that you, when she asked you, what are you going to do with your life? And you said, in effect, I'm going into crime. How do you explain that now? I mean, you're a celebrated poet. Let's be serious. And I could spend the whole hour admiring this book, which I've reread a couple of times in the last month, Another Bull Blank Night in Suck City. I mean, this is real, real great American writing, but where were you then, aspiring to crime?
Well, yeah, and when I was a teenager, my mother, you know, my father was in federal prison. My father, who the book is about, who I encountered on the streets when he showed up at the Pine Street Inn after he'd been released from federal prison. But when I was around 15, he began sending me letters from federal prison. And at that time, my mother was actually involved with someone who was another gangster of sorts. I guess that's a drug runner. He was a drug runner. These were the people that she was attracted to, that were in our lives. These were the people in our lives for, I'm not sure exactly the reason. There was, you know, we all had levels of addiction going on and all maybe an attraction to this lawlessness. That's what I considered doing. I seriously considered. So I actually worked for these for one of her last boyfriend,
who was bringing serious drugs in on boats into plain old beautiful lighthouse situate. I mean, it's astonishing.
Well, he was bringing them into Maine and then driving them down, so that you couldn't bring them into situate, but he would bring them into Maine. I decided that was a good life. I decided that would be the thing to do. It was mostly a class thing. Also, we were broke and. These guys, you know, these guys suddenly had a lot of money. They'd come from Boston, and they showed me around Boston. I saw, you know, they used to go to Good Time Charlie's when it was still open. They would go to this strip joint when it was still open. So it was very ironic for me to move in post after they had all been arrested and gone to jail, and then Good Time Charlie's had been closed, and you know, everything had sort of fallen apart. It's very, you know, in that sense, it's a very noir story also, because it's actually not even at the height of the, you know, the gangster. You know, their gangsterdom. There was actually, you know, at the tail end when it was all falling apart.
Nick Flynn,
when I moved in.
So. Could I just throw out a question? I mean, what if noir, for you, for us readers and moviegoers, but especially for you, especially for your father, what if noir is always a kind of dream, a way of getting inside the dreams and the nightmares of dropouts, of casualties?
What I like about noir, what sort of attracts me to it is, I mean, one of the things that I think that really seems to, like, if I think about my father particularly, like, what would, or how I would line him up as a noir character is, the, you know, in most noir, there's some sort of people trying to be what they're not. Maybe they say they're writers, but they don't really write, like in Sunset Boulevard, or they wear masks in various, you know, either actual masks or just, you know, metaphoric masks, you know, to rob banks, you know, real masks like in The Killing or in Eddie Coyle or in, you know, The Town.
Or the
driven by these dark passions, you know, of greed, lust, and desire for fame or ego. And there's something very elemental about all that, that seems like it does. You had mentioned at the beginning in the intro that it's some, you know, some relationship to capitalism, to underground capitalism, like it's just sort of the real reduced to its base level. And there's something about that I think really resonates still, because it does seem like, you know, on a metaphoric level, like this is really, if you strip everything away from our culture, our system right now, even now, this is what would remain, is this sort of these base desires.
So. I'm thinking also that your father created a sort of noir hero for himself. Here he was, you know, living in a faded glory of a man who'd had bad breaks, but was still going to make it. He was going to write that book. He told you he was living out the myth, and you heard echoes of Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson in his voice. And there's this marvelous couple of sentences from a letter he wrote to you. He said, "I thought if your very beautiful mother were alive and if she could somehow see this scene, her youngest son at work and his father a resident in the Pine Street Inn, a shelter for the homeless, the beaten, the sad, the losers in life's great game, your mother, Jody, would have laughed out loud at the entire macabre scene."
Yeah.
We're talking about Boston noir as a sort of aesthetic key to a tale of two cities, especially the underground Boston, beloved of novelists and Hollywood. Here is a moment from Ben Affleck's movie The Town. We're in the flower shop owned by a crime boss. The Ben Affleck character is trying to get himself out of a robbery assignment, and the gangster florist is telling him, "No way.
You're going to do this for me? I'm going to clip your nuts. Like I clip your daddy's.
Don't talk about my father.
Son, I knew your daddy. He worked for me for years. Years. Then he wanted his own thing. Pray the horses? You know, they either geld a horse with a knife or with the chemicals. And your daddy said no to me. I did him the chemical way. Gave your mother a taste. Put the hook into her. Now she doped up good and proper. Hung herself with a wire on Melnair Cass. And you, run around the neighborhood looking for her. Your daddy didn't have the heart to tell his son that he was looking for a suicide doper who was never coming home. If there's a heaven, son, she ain't in it."
That's from Ben Affleck's movie, The Town. We're talking about Boston noir, the aesthetic version that Hollywood can't let go of. Nick Flynn, the novelist and, I mean, the memoirist and poet, is with us from New York. Rick Marinick is in our studio. He's my friend for 25 years now. That scene from The Town must ring vaguely familiar, Rick, to people who set up crews to take down armored trucks.
Yes, it really did, I think, to some degree, Chris. I never worked for – no one ever ordered us to do anything. We decided what we were going to do, when we were going to do it. But we did have problems with personnel. And this Irish gentleman seemed to be having problems with Ben Affleck. And the problems that we ran across was people agreeing to initially come into the score and then deciding, in fact, that they couldn't do it. They couldn't go through with it. Maybe they got a little stage fright, for lack of a better word.
Can I just say, I met Rick Marinick in a Boston University classroom inside Norfolk Prison. He was doing an 18-year sentence for armed robbery. His specialty was armored trucks. A one-time state trooper and a very good writer, too, from day one. His novel, Boyos, is the best book I've ever read on Whitey Bulger from the inside. He also wrote In for a Pound, a novel, and a whole stack of work in progress, both fiction and memoir. You've been writing and talking hardcore noir, Rick, since I met you. But locate, as Nick did, the sort of the space that that your noir lives in.
I think the space for me, Chris, is it started when I was a very, very young boy going into the North End, when the North End was totally controlled and dominated by La Cosa Nostra, the New England branch of La Cosa Nostra. And my father was, for whatever reason, he was very friendly with these gentlemen. And I remember going in and meeting these people on Saturday mornings. My father had business in the North End. He wasn't a gangster. He wasn't a criminal. But he had an association with these men for whatever reason. And I remember going in, and I looked at the way my father, I observed the way my father looked at these men and the respect that he gave them and the sense of awe that he got from these men. And that rubbed off on me. I said, my father's impressed by these guys. Maybe I could be down the road. I could be something like them and receive the same type of respect from somebody else. And then as I got older, my father had a body shop. I remember leaving the body shop in the summers when I worked there as a kid, and one of his men would drive me home, but would always stop in a little bar room on Washington Street in the South End underneath the elevated train tracks. And it was a real, like a Friends of Eddie Coyle type bar. And I remember sitting there and watching the trains go by overhead and standing out on the sidewalk with my little Coke, looking at the people going by, the pimps, the winos, the street hustlers, and saying, wow, this place is alive. This is where I'm alive. And it stuck with me. And then as I got older, naturally, you know, things happened.
There's something Matt Damon character in The Departed in your story. I mean, the kid who grows up loving, admiring Whitey Bulgers of this world. Also John Connolly, the guy, the FBI guy who's doing federal time forever for fronting for these guys. What was it?
I think when they're doing what a lot of people would like to do. They don't answer to people. They don't have any bosses. They don't have to follow the laws. They do what they want, when they want, to whoever they want to. And they get away with it. And they get respect. And they earn money. And there's a sense of power about them. And people pick up on this. That's why they call them outlaws. People admire these people. I'm reading a book right now on Blackbeard. And I didn't know he was a cult figure while he operated in England. People really, really love this guy.
In the Boston story, the whole noir thing, it seems to me, is inseparable from obvious open corruption of public process, of the cops, in Whitey Bulger's case, of, you could say, the whole federal and state and local cop establishment. Isn't that kind of the most extraordinary sort of necessity in the whole Boston setting of these stories? They're all about corruption, that nobody's straight.
Well, you know, again, I mean, you look at the federal government and you have to question why the federal government, when James Bulger was attempting to present his defense, one of the things he said was, I am not a paid top echelon informant. They would not allow him to do this. And why wouldn't they allow him to present his defense? I mean, if this is a fantasy story, let him get in the stand, let them cut him to ribbons and prove it to be a fantasy. But no, they wouldn't even allow him to present that defense. So who's more corrupt, the guy with the badge or the guy who's running around the street with the guns for years?
Rick, take us through some of those stories that you're drawing on every day, writing memoir, writing fiction. Put us in some of those spots. I also want to hear you talk about prison noir, the underground life inside a prison. You were there almost 20 years.
Okay, I mean, just briefly, I was driving, I told you earlier, Chris, I was driving through Kenmore Square tonight, and you talk about a noir setting. 35 years ago, I worked in a series of nightclubs in the Kenmore Square district, which was teeming with nightclubs and bars. You come through there tonight, and the place is empty. There are no more nightclubs. There are very few bars. And I remember when I was it was, again, 35 years ago, when the bars would let out at 2 o'clock, it was like someone tugged the handle of a giant toilet somewhere. And from the bars and nightclubs, these teeming masses would pour into the street. And they were drunk, they were drugged up, and there'd be maybe six or seven cops standing in front of the pizza pad, placidly watching this spectacle in front of thousands of people. And there'd be kids dancing, kids doing burnouts with music blasting from their cars, couples embracing. There'd be a fight would flare up over in one corner, another, and go down, another fight would flare up in another corner, and no one got involved. Today, I'm driving through tonight, and I'm looking at Kenmore Square, and at the Eastern Standard Bar tonight, maybe at 2 o'clock, maybe Ted and Marie comes out after they're sipping craft beer and fireball shots, and they call an Uber cab in an empty Kenmore Square, and they drive to the North End for cannolis.
This is strange, because you came to hate Whitey Bulger with a passion, but you've also admitted to missing him.
I had a strong dislike for the guy for various reasons.
How well did you know him?
We weren't buddies. We knew each other.
When he said, get in the car, did you do?
When he said, get in the car, you got in the car. That was it. Obviously, in the situation.
I thought that was the one thing you didn't do.
Well, the thing is, with my situation, because it was just him and me, I got in the car because we had business to discuss. But for the most part, no. If he said, get in the car, and he's driving, and someone was sitting in back, you never got in the car because you never got out alive.
You say the guys in bars in South Boston don't want to fight anymore.
I don't think it's just the bars in South Boston. I read a quote by a Boston police officer. This is probably 6 months ago, and he said, thankfully, he said, in this generation, he said, all the fight seems to be bred out of these kids today. Where in the old days, you were fighting constantly. I worked nightclubs as a bouncer for 15 years, and we were fighting constantly. I thank God today the kids are the way they are, because I don't want to fight anymore, obviously.
Our phone is 800-423-8255. We're talking about the genre of movies and books called noir, and the space in our head that just seems to love it. Nick Flynn in New York. I mean, there's a difference of generations here and of trades. Ricky dealt in broken legs and armored trucks. You're in a world that's sort of halfway to Philip Seymour Hoffman's city here of addiction, drugs, alcohol. I mean, did your paths cross? Did your imaginative paths cross?
Well, I don't think I was ever cut out to be a real hard guy. So, and my father also, like when I finally did encounter him, he seemed to be almost a caricature of a gangster in some way. I made this short film at some point after he'd gotten off the streets, and I sort of looked him up, and as I was beginning to write the book, I interviewed him, and he seemed like I realized like everything he was saying sounded vaguely like something I'd heard in a movie. So I went back and made this sort of short documentary called How to Rob a Bank, because he had done time for robbing banks, but I took these quotes from Edward G. Robinson and Fred McMurray and Sterling Hayden. And just sort of put him next to what he was saying, because it seemed very much like almost a performance of toughness rather than some genuine thing. Maybe it's just not in our blood or something. But it's more about, I think the noir thing for me is more almost about this, about just sort of desperation just among people trying to get something. It might be violence through violence, or it might just be through trying to pretend to be something you're not. And I think that's still there. I think that's still in the culture. I think it's actually even I don't think it's gone away. And I think the reason we're still interested in it is because we're, one thing, the gap between the rich and the poor is worse than it actually was back in 30 years ago. It's like now it's even this real tangible thing that everyone sort of recognizes. And, that's sort of going to produce a lot of sort of noir mentality.
Rick, I wonder, are you aware of the performance piece in your own personality?
Of course.
Thank you.
Jim, I was told that Jim Bulger, Whitey Bulger, used to practice in the mirror. I mean, practices looks, practices lines, practices delivery, his threats, that type of stuff. I was told that he would practice in the mirror to see how he was coming across. And I was told this by his close associates.
Do you practice?
No, I don't. No, I don't. It's just that kind of it's natural. I'm sure it was natural for Whitey. It's pretty much natural for me. I wasn't a gang leader. I had my own little crew, and people knew where I stood. And the bottom line is, I was calling the shots many times. And of course, it was a democratic organization, and we all had input. But I was calling the shots, and if you didn't like it, you could leave.
Nick Flynn, do you have an opinion on the peculiar Boston piece? I mean, it's famous for the accents of all these people, but I mean, what about the church in the background? I mean, that Mitchum line where, he learned this from the nuns, whack them with a steel ruler, hard, and if they don't stick their hands out across the face. But guilt, you name it. What are the peculiar Boston elements here?
For me, I mean, you know, again, I just go back to, you know, the story of my father. He was a weird hybrid. I mean, we probably all feel like strange hybrids of some sort in America, and maybe even like outsiders in some way. Like, I grew up in an Irish Catholic town, Scituate, but yet my mother raised us Protestant. She could have raised us Catholic just as easily, but she chose to raise us Protestant. And I really felt that my father was really raised Catholic, yet when he moved into Boston, he established himself on Beacon Hill. You know, he sort of went to the WASP stronghold. And I think sort of being there and feeling like an outsider there and feeling like he's trying to sort of like claw his way into some sort of respectability through either art or, and then he just decided to do it through robbing banks. He really wanted fame. And I think
I love the picture in your book of your father in tennis whites walking through Harvard Square with a tennis racket under his arm. He never played tennis, but he thought he would say, "I'm trawling for Radcliffe girls or something."
Yeah. Looking for. He was always about costume, about the different costume to wear to for the appropriate moment. And it was just trying things on. There's something about that, about the sort of not really knowing who you are in some sense and not really having a. And trying on things. He always seemed, when I first met him, he seemed like this mix of, you know, he was from the, you know, 50s, 40s and 50s. And he seemed like a mix of a sort of like Sinatra Rat Pack, sort of the self-possession with sort of this Kerouac irresponsibility, sort of the two sort of male archetypes of the time. And then he sort of somehow picked up these film noir sort of like cadences to his voice and to his phrasing of how he talked about things. And, you know, he probably got it from going to jail. He probably had to, you know, he sort of, when he started running with that crowd, he had to start talking like them, you know, so.
Rick Marinick, what does a guy with your eye see in prison in terms of role-playing, bluffing, acting, performing?
Well, you know, I reflect back to something that Nick mentioned. There's a mafia figure in Norfolk State Prison. His name was Frank Orito, and he was a mafia capo from Revere. And he used to affect a lot of the, along with some of the other mafiosos that I associated with for years in Norfolk, they would affect the Marlon Brando type of attitude and the way they talk, the vernacular.
Which Brando? Waterfront Brando?
This is the Godfather Brando.
Oh.
And the Godfather. And I was told that the mafia, the modern mafia, learned how to be the mafioso by watching the Godfather.
Really?
How to act like them, yeah.
Another question for you, Rick. When you try to see what's going on today in drug traffic or crime of all kinds, where do you go and what are you studying? What are you learning?
I missed the question, Chris. I mean,
where do you see this kind of criminal activity, the kind of stuff that you did?
Oh, you don't. I mean, that's why you confuse me, because right now, in this day and age, as far as I can see, there's nothing going on. There is nothing.
But surely there is in terms of drug deals.
There's credit card fraud. You have your marijuana importers. You have your drug dealing. But as far as my world, the Irish mob world, that's dead. You don't have the armored car gangs. You don't have the bank robbing crews.
We start the year, January of 14, Rick, with, you know, a spate of murders. Back up again in Boston.
But where are the murders happening? It's all in the other city. And what are the murders happening over? It's disrespect. It's maybe a small turf struggle. It could be over. These kids today, I talked to Boston police officers, gang unit officers, and they tell me they kill for the smallest things. You look at someone wrong, you can get shot. It's not the same thing, Chris. Murders don't equal gang organizations, armored car groups, bank robbers, large loan sharking rings. They don't have the stuff going on.
But you're saying, is that the new noir or is that the end of noir?
It could be the new noir. It's maybe it's morphing, but as far as the old style gangsterism, it's gone. With Boston, the South Boston Irish mob was the last Irish mob, recognized Irish mob in the country. There are no more. The mafia is broken in Boston. It's broken in New York. It's broken in Providence.
We've got to nail this, Nick Flynn, before we're done. I mean, Dennis Lehane is maybe among the chief warriors that, you know, with a prosperous city in Boston, there's not enough housing for the kinds of people who play these kinds of roles and who talk the way these guys did. I mean, who's going to be, are we worried about the exhaustion of noir, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be, like, every day, you know, the sun sets every day, and it's going to be night, and it's going to be shadows, and people are going to have bad impulses, and people are going to go out and, you know, do things that maybe are against their or their loved one's interests.
Danger, excitement, adventure. Boston Blackie.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What do we talk about when we talk about noir? Is it over? Is it deep? Is it as real Boston as the Museum of Fine Arts or Symphony Hall or the Athenaeum? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. Anna Mundo enters by phone from Shutesbury, Massachusetts. With an immense literary sophistication about all this, she writes the Crime and Punishment column in the Barnes & Noble Review, and she reviews rafts of books for the Irish Times and the Washington Post. Anna Mundo, welcome.
Thank you, Christopher. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I want you to explain why we like this semi-psychopathic slice of life.
Well, you know, it's hard to listen to Nick and to Rick in different ways, hard to listen to the details of some of the things they've seen and they've lived through. It's a far cry from the stylish kind of tilt of the fedora noir that we're used to seeing, even in the later days, seeing some of the pastiche of that. And it strikes me as I'm listening that this is really why, in a way, we're still drawn to the form, I think, is that it allows readers to experience vicariously what Nick and Rick have seen, have lived through. Mm. We just don't have to go through it. We can feel that sense of titillation. We can imagine the forbidden. And that's very appealing. And at the end of a novel, a movie, whatever it is, it may not resolve itself tidily, but there will be a conclusion. And that's a kind of neatness in itself.
Anna Mundo, I wish you'd just take these witnesses apart a little bit. I mean, what do you make of them as characters? Nick Flynn, kid from the suburbs, who like a moth to the flame, heads right down his father's ruinous trail, catches himself. But Rick Marinick does it both, actually. He's the Matt Damon kid who's drawn into the mob, but he's also the cop, who played him?
In the Departed?
Yeah, was it Marky Mark?
It was Leo Damon.
Leo DiCaprio played the cop, though, who infiltrated the mob. So you've done that too. You got into the work and you've come out writing about it. How do you explain that, Anna?
I don't think I can explain it. I can admire it, and I admire both in their very different ways. Nick's courage, Rick's courage, in looking coldly on this world, on the worlds that they've come from, and that they're still part of. It's not as though they've removed themselves entirely from what they grew up in. But I'm also struck by what they both said in different ways about people escaping into their imaginary notions of themselves. This sort of fake grandeur, which is often a completely recognizable characteristic of any noir kind of villain or indeed hero, this grander than reality figure, and really who at bottom has no nobility except perhaps a kind of exhausted endurance at the end, something again that we can admire. But I think Rick and Nick, neither of them are characters in their own dramas. That's one of the other things I admire about them greatly.
Let me ask you, Anna, not that much room for females in this world. It's fascinating. I mean, there is that incredible sofa full of harpy sisters lined up against Mark Wahlberg in The Fighter, an amazing scene. And the mother there is an extraordinarily strong character. And then there's also in that movie, the Amy Adams girl that the sisters ridicule as the girl from an MTV girl, you know, working the bar.
Mm-hmm.
But how would you expand the possibilities for the female persuasion in this set of stories?
I think it's already being expanded. It's interesting to think of Scottish writer Denise Mina from Glasgow, who writes a marvelous series of, well, they're crime novels. You can call them noir if you like. They're certainly, they're bleak enough, they're rain-soaked enough, and there isn't much nobility going on there either. And her main, you know, her protagonist is Detective Superintendent Alex Morrow, who's a woman. And she goes through the trials that we normally expect a male figure to go through, and she's exhausted and soul-weary and world-weary and, you know, struggling with all the things that we expect. Mm. So I think it's happening already. I think it's really great to see, you know, we're no longer really confronted, except, as I say, in some of these pastiches of noir, which are kind of surfacing these days. There you get the sort of vamp figure, which we're all a bit tired of. We also get the kind of the Madonna and the mother and all of that.
Yeah, interesting. That's a little bit of Eddie Coyle's wife, I think.
Yes, yeah.
Back home at the ironing board. Anna Mundo, stand by. We're talking about Boston noir, and our phone is 800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Boston.
Yeah, Christopher, it's so wonderful to be on. This is Jim O'Connell. I'm actually, I work the Healthcare for the Homeless program in Boston, and I am thrilled.
The Dr. Jim O'Connell.
I am, yes. And I worked for many years with Nick, and I think his book is one of the real wonders of our of homeless literature, not to mention Nick's poetry, which also has its noir side. But I wanted to call in and just give a little support for not only the show, but I was struck by having worked for sort of 20-some years on the van, the same van that Nick worked on, is that the underbelly of Boston, where people, you know, kind of create their own lives against the backdrop of the nighttime city, is just a magnetism and a mystery to it that just draws us. And when I read Nick's book, he captured that that feeling so unbelievably wonderfully. And Rick, I'm sorry I have not read your book yet, but I am equally drawn to the fascinating story of Weddy Bulger, and I look forward to reading it.
Jim O'Connell, can I reintroduce you, Jim O'Connell? I mean, I know you now, and you've been on a radio show with us probably 15 years ago, but I always think of you as the doctor who washes his patient's feet in the after the example of Jesus, but also you spoke of it as a kind of diagnostic device.
We did. That was some, and Nick would remember this very well. In the clinic at Pine Street Inn, the nurses, when I first arrived there, taught us that the only way to get to know folks out on the streets and in the shelters was to take time to get to know them, and they had me soak feet for many months when I first started. Rather than doing any doctoring, we had to soak feet and slowly get to know folks, and it was magic, totally magic.
Nick Flynn, does this sound familiar?
Well, it's great to hear you, Jim. Thanks so much for calling in. You're someone who's changed my life in many ways. And I just want to respond to something you said just about like the you know, what happens at night on the streets in Boston when we're out on the homeless outreach van and finding these folks. And you know, what Anna said also about there's no nobility in the, you know, in these sort of characters of, you know, the sort of the classic noir characters. Like, that was one thing in my book. I you know, I was hoping actually to sort of somehow actually elevate the characters in it, and to sort of show some, you know, nobility even in just their struggles, their daily struggles, and in even some tragedy too. Like the idea that maybe they're like, you know, I love Dennis Lehane, and I think it's true. I think it's sort of classic noir. They're you know, they're too small for tragedy. You know, they'd fall off a curb rather than the thing. But yet, I find like great, you know, I think the ones that really draw us in is sort of when we see sort of a common person that actually isn't too small for tragedy. There's a tragic element to someone even trying to be a little bit better than they are and you know, maybe making a mistake doing that, maybe to make it a bad mistake doing that, like and getting into some like situation that you could imagine, you know, just sort of, you know, one step leads to another and suddenly you're in this, you know, dark, very dark place that all you wanted to do was be a little better than you were or something. So yeah. I think there's a great tragedy in that and actually even a nobility in trying to find one's way out of it. So yeah. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, Nick. I want to thank Jim O'Connell for calling. And Jim, I just want to walk the walk with you one night before the cold lets up. Thank you, Jim.
You can wash my feet, Chris, anytime.
That's a deal. That's a deal. Yeah. The phone's 800-423-8255. We're talking about The Charms of Boston Noir. Tony is on the line from Boston.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good, Tony. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for bringing the subject up. I was just wondering, Rick, back in the day, right in the 80s, yeah, remember Dominic's?
Oh, yes, I do. Right down on Tremont Street.
Yep.
Nice place.
But you know what's missing is the lack of respect.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like what my father's Cadillac was the same color as Langone's funeral home Cadillac.
Yeah.
You know, they had like that triple blue.
Sure, I remember
that. When I went on a date with my girlfriend at the time, we went up to the North End, and these guys parked the car for me. I had no idea why. And this girl was like, who, you know? And I'm like, I have no idea.
You know? Who are you, Tony?
Huh?
She was wondering, who am I walking down the street with?
Exactly, right? And then, oh, what's the other places we used to go? Like in South Boston, like you said, like the fights out of everybody.
Yeah.
I can remember going a couple places and just, you know, you said the wrong thing, and boom, there was a bloodbath out in front.
It's lights out. You know, Tony, you bring up an interesting point about the lack of respect. I remember when I was in prison. I had about another 2 years ago, and there was a guy named Ronnie Mack. He was a South Boston killer. He was doing a double natural life. And he told me, he said, Ricky, he said, when you get outside, he said, you have to be careful. He said, because you're going out into a very rude society. He said, and where before, he said, you just want to beat them. He said, now you're going to want to kill them. He said, so that's what you're going out into. He said, ooh. Because prison, most people aren't aware, Tony, prison is a very, very polite society. Because if you disrespect someone or you're rude to someone, it could literally cost you your life. Hmm. So you learn to be polite. You learn to be respectful.
Does everybody learn?
Most people do. And the ones that don't, you'll see them carted out of there.
Annamundo, I want you, especially with that marvelous accent of yours, I want you to sort of make a ruling on the Irish and Irish Catholic dimensions of all this. Not just the names and the guys, but the fantasies, the sort of metaphysical premises on which all this takes place.
Oh, I see. You're leaving the easy part to last.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's really easy. Well, I don't know that I can put any Irishness on it, really. I know that's a bit of a disappointment. But I think as far as Boston goes, any transplanted, you know, immigrant group is going to create its own sense of uniqueness. It's going to feel it has a unique sense of humor, unique toughness, unique gangs, all of that. That's the story of any country that has an immigrant population. So I suppose the Irish, you know, Irish people would like to think we're unique in all our wonderful sardonic humor. But I don't think, I was thinking about this a lot today, and I can't see I can't see noir in the Irish literary tradition anyway. Perhaps because we didn't have gangsters, you know, we had criminals, plenty of them, and many of them were in the government and in the Catholic Church. We had psychopathic killers; they were mostly paramilitaries, and that was part of our glorious nationalist tradition. But we weren't really urban enough for noir to develop, and there was really no mystery very much in Irish society. There was lots of secrecy, not much mystery. Now we have it all. I mean, we have criminal gangs, drug wars, crooked cops, and so we have the novels of a writer like Gene Kerrigan, who portrays all of that.
Interesting. 800-423-8255 joins the conversation about Boston noir. Alan is calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Welcome, Alan.
How are you doing?
Good.
Yes, great show. I had a comment and a question for Nick. I lived in the South End for a while, but also in Provincetown for a while. I know Nick lived down there, and there's a real dark underbelly of P-Town as well, with, you know, drug dealing and smugglers and like the gay community and the hetero community sort of meeting at this nexus after the bars closed and everything, and you know, card playing and stuff. And I was wondering if you had any idea of writing anything about that link. The whole Boston scene as well, and what he has any comments on. I used to live there back in the 90s in a place called 128 Commercial Street.
Did you own 128 Commercial?
I sure did.
That's Norman Norman Mailer's old neighborhood, isn't it?
I used to go, well, that was the other side of town. This is the West, you were in the West End, Alan. I know your house. I went into your house. Your house was a very noir house at the time, I remember, in the 80s. You'd go in there and...
Yeah,
that's sort of, that was the center of darkness there for a while. In a good way. I mean, I was very drawn to that house. I saw you know, I had in my 20s in Provincetown was my, you know, that was when my addictions flourished. And Provincetown was a very good place to go from Boston. You could, especially in the summers, it just sort of followed you there. Like you could get whatever you wanted, whatever you needed. And, you know, and then it seemed like a very dark town to me. It seemed like a very dark and desperate town to me. And then I got clean and I still go to Provincetown. And now it seems like a very sort of light and healthy town to me. But I think both exist. I think it exists. It depends on what corner you look at and how late you stay up at night and what houses you go into. As far as I can tell, I mean, I always found Provincetown to be fascinating and wonderful because it could absorb almost anyone who didn't fit in anywhere else could fit in Provincetown. Mm. And I don't think that's true anymore in Provincetown, although it still has some of that energy, though. But I'm not sure if that's still true there. But I think that's also something people sort of on the margins that sort of have a hard time fitting in other places, you know, finding these places to fit in. Sometimes it's just the night that you fit into.
Last word from Rick Marinick. Rick, what are you going to do for us readers in your new novel? Briefly.
Chris, the new novel, it focuses on black gangs in Boston. And the Boston police struggle with a particular black gangster. So I'm going off into the Dorchester, Mattapan, Roxbury district to weave my story, basically.
Good luck. We want to go with you. The last line goes to William Monahan, screenwriter of the Oscar movie The Departed. He was born in Dorchester in 1960. He spent his life studying English and American theater, starting with Shakespeare. On this question of whether Boston noir will survive, he says, "I'll be writing about Boston as long as I live, but whether or not I do it in the form of a Departed sequel is up to other people. I'd honestly love to bring back Dignam." That's the Mark Wahlberg character. "And I know how the picture would open, with the Departed tango and snow falling on the Boston Common. I know every scene in the picture," he says. Thanks to Mark Eisenberg of Sudbury for suggesting it. There are noir links and photographs and extra reading and much more on our website, radioopensource.org. Thanks to Emily Sweeney and Howie Carr for sharing their photos of Boston mobsters. Keep the Boston noir conversation going and catch up with other projects that we're working on. Next week, healthcare prescriptions from the developing world. Our show is produced by the Boyos, Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and George Hicks on the radio controls. Mary McGrath is our crime boss. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
I thought I was the stranger around here. This ain't my part of Boston, Lieutenant.
Have a nice day.